On the 27th of March, the Coffee House Shots team will be joined by special guests to give you their take on a spring statement. We will be live on stage at London's Cadogan Hall. To get your tickets today, visit spectator.co.uk/springstatementlive. We'll see you there.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. I am delighted to be joined today by DeRoy Murdoch of Fox News and a friend of The Spectator who is here in London. Once again, you come back quite regularly, don't you, DeRoy? It's a yearly visit.
I come back as often as I'm invited, and I was fortunate enough to be invited this time by the Ferris Foundation as the last time I was here. They were kind enough to bring me over here and arrange a dinner in Oxford, which I enjoyed, one in London, which I couldn't attend due to illness, and I regret not being there very much, and also very thankful for my old friend Jeremy Hildreth, who's instrumental in arranging everything I do over here in the United Kingdom.
Who's sitting right here looking discreet.
As ever.
So, DeRoy, let's talk about Donald Trump, since that's all one can talk about at the moment.
He does dominate things, doesn't he?
Yesterday was another extraordinary day in the Trump presidency. They seem to get more and more extraordinary. So it began with a Truth Social post about retaliatory tariffs on Canada. He said Canada had said they would do retaliatory tariffs. Trump said, I'm going to make it 50%, 25% to 50%. Huge jump on a Truth Social post in which he then elaborated on why Canada should be the 51st state. That sort of rumbled on. The markets were having another dip, everybody attributing that to the tariffs. And then he did this extraordinary press event with Elon Musk, where they stood outside the White House and talked about Teslas, almost as though they were on a shopping channel. And it's true that Joe Biden did a similar thing with, Jeep?
He did, as a matter of fact, yeah, with some kind of electric car, which he drove. We actually got to see Joe Biden drive.
Yeah, so everybody's saying this is a new kind of ridiculous, was off the mark because Biden had already done it. But Trump does bring his own special ridiculousness to these events. And the reason why he was doing it with Elon Musk was because he was feeling bad that Tesla's stock, probably as a result of the tariff panics, has dipped considerably since he's been in office. So he was trying to support Tesla, support the so-called first buddy. But I think there is a sense, even among people that were quite pro-Trump, that this has not been a good week. The economy, you know, everybody's going to say Main Street is going to do better and Wall Street's not Main Street, etc. But Wall Street does matter to Trump. And I mean, this dip in the markets will be alarming him.
I would think so. In fact, I took a look just today. I saw where the Dow is, and who knows where it'll close today, but it closed on Tuesday. I guess that would be the 11th of March, yes, at 41,393. That's down from 44,882 January 30th, which would be 10 years. Getting the timing off here. I should say January 30th, 10 days after he came to office. So 10 days after he was sworn in, is 44, almost 45,000. And now it's at 41,400 approximately. And who knows where it's going to be at the time people hear this recording. But I believe Donald J. Trump was elected to see the markets go up, not down. And so I guess people are concerned about a number of things. One of them, I think, is this tariff situation. And a lot of us who are pro-Trump feel about the tariffs that if they are basically to be used as blunt instrument trauma to get the attention of countries so they do the things we want, whether it's getting Mexico to seal the border, getting Canada to seal the northern border, certainly in the first term to get the Chinese to pay attention and get what we needed done on things like intellectual property protection and so forth, then that's fine. But if the tariffs become a policy in and of themselves and the ideas for them not to be waved over someone's head like a baton and to get them frightened and compliant, but in fact to be something that actually ends up increasing prices, I think it's going to be very, very difficult and problematic. I've heard the comment made by people who are in favor of tariffs, many of them are on Trump, that they're not taxes because they'll be paid by foreign governments. We all know that the tariffs are going to end up getting paid, even if they do get paid by the foreign governments. They'll turn around on the other side and just boost prices to make up that money. This is what always happens. So they're basically a sales tax of a sort. You might call them an international sales tax. I don't want to see this happen. Again, if this is just a way of scaring people so they do what we want, that's one thing. But if these tariffs are going to stick, they're going to be economically problematic. I think the timing on this is totally backward. What we need right now is a massive tax cut. We need the Trump tax cuts to be extended, made permanent. I very much want to see President Trump's promises of no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security benefits, no tax on overtime implemented and put into law. I want to see all that happen on or by, actually probably on the date, April 15th, which is our tax day. So as Americans are sending in their taxes, to be able to have a tax cut kick in that day, that will do a number of things. I think that will stimulate the economy right away. It will give people a sense of certainty about what the market, what the tax structure is going to be in 2026 and beyond. Right now, people are trying to make planning and purchasing decisions without knowing, is my tax next year going to be this or this or the other? Will it be under the current Trump structure? Will go back to the previous structure, which is higher? There are a lot of questions about this. So right now, there's a lot of uncertainty about where the tax situation is. Will we get a tax cut or not? When is it going to happen? With all the tariffs on top of this, and all these things are slowing down the economy. So I would get, if I were Donald J. Trump, I'd get off the tariff gas pedal and tap the brakes and get on the tax cut pedal and push down as hard as possible.
Well, he picked Scott Bessent as his Treasury Secretary, apparently because he thought he was the ideal candidate to not spook the markets, but who also would get behind the tariffs agenda. And I wonder what you thought about that, because it seems to me with the Canada story yesterday, jumping up to 50%, and then it seems relenting overnight, and that was just a threat. You have a real mystery evolving about what Trump actually thinks these tariffs are for. They are negotiating tariffs in some ways. I've heard them called. We had an article by Orrin Cass about how he's using them as negotiating tariffs. That's one thing. But they can also be tariffs. It seems Trump believes this. They can be tariffs that will benefit working class America, that will bring back industry, that will, increase the Main Street economy. And it perhaps, the stock market has been overpriced for a while and it is due some sort of correction, and Trump's willing to swallow that. What do you think he's thinking in that mysterious orange head?
that beautiful glowing.
If I can talk about your president,
by all means, with that beautiful bright golden hair of his.
Yeah.
Well, if there is any sort of a market correction due, I don't think that. I think it's for reasons probably separate from whatever the tariff situation is. Like the tariff thing is maybe accelerating that, perhaps. But far be it for me to say where the actual market price level should be. But I think the whole situation here with the tariffs, if these are negotiating tariffs, that's fine. If they're going to stick, it might be appropriate to say, all right, this isn't a negotiating tariff. We really want it to stick on there. It should be 10% rather than 10% one day, 50% one day, 25%. I mean, literally changing on a daily basis. If God forbid, we're going to have a full-blown tariff policy, it'd be a lot easier to know what the tariff is, and U.S. companies doing business in Canada can plan accordingly. It's very hard to plan if this ball is bouncing up and down day by day and not by a percentage or two, but doubling one day, being cut 50% the next day and back 100% the next day. Nobody can plan in that kind of a fashion. I think I agree with something that President Trump tried to do in his first term. I believe at one of the G20 meetings, he brought up the idea with everyone around the table at the conference table. I forget which of the meetings. Why don't we all just have zero tariffs and total free trade, and all of us can just exchange goods and services across borders unfettered? And the response to that was, unfortunately, I think you ought to go back, now that he's again president of the United States, even more powerful than he was before, and say, look, rather than play games with tariffs, which I'm happy to do anytime you want, why don't we all fly into Washington, D.C. or Geneva or Riyadh, wherever it may be, and sit on a table and see if we all can agree to have exactly what I said, unfettered trade across borders without tariffs. And just if you want to buy something across the Atlantic from the UK, or you British people want to buy something from Guatemala, or the Guatemalans want to buy something from Singapore, knock yourselves out, get it on a boat, sail it across, and deliver the goods to consumers. I'd love to see that. And I think Trump would really put himself in a better situation if he tried to do that. If it works, wonderful. We go to a situation of total global free trade. Wouldn't that be beautiful? If it doesn't, and they say, no, we're not interested, puts him on much firmer ground to be able to say, look, I tried to have free trade. I tried to do it the way that Milton Friedman and Adam Smith would like. The world is not interested. So then we're going to have to go back and do it through the tariff fashion, which I would not like to see. But I think it'd put him on a much firmer ground. And if he's a strong enough personality, he might be able to get people to agree to something like this. If it's not a tariff of zero, maybe it's a universal 5% tariff across the board, which isn't huge. It does give a little bit of an advantage, I suppose, to domestic producers versus international people importing from overseas, but not a huge one. And I think we could go forward that way much more intelligently than bouncing around from 10% to 50 to 20 to 15 to 35 to 40 to 60 to zero, as we've seen happening with tariffs with Mexico, with Canada, with other, and with China and other countries around the world.
You mentioned China. I mean, China is the real strategic reason for these tariffs. And it seems to be the country that is shaping a lot of the Trump administration's foreign policy thinking, particularly the story that I should have mentioned, but I didn't, that happened yesterday, Ukraine. A ceasefire is now on. The ball is in Russia's court, as Marco Rubio said. And it's clear that for the Trump administration, Russia is a threat, a power rival in some ways, but it's not its primary concern. Its primary concern is China. Am I right in saying that?
I think in the long term, that's true. The Chinese are very, very slow and sneaky. You know, they don't think in terms of quarters or years like we Americans do. They think in terms of decades and centuries. I don't know if this is a true story, but it's certainly attributed to Henry Kissinger speaking with Zhou Enlai, the sort of vice president of China under, or vice dictator of China, let's call him that, under Mao Zedong. And apparently back when the discussions were going on with Nixon and Mao and Kissinger and the others, Kissinger asked Zhou Enlai, do you think the French Revolution was a success? And Zhou Enlai responded, too soon to tell. So again, they think in terms of centuries. So I think over the long term, yes, we have to watch China. They are a hegemonic power. They do not have U.S. interests at the top of their list of to-do list, certainly. And I think certainly in the short term, what Trump is trying to do is score an early victory for not just himself, but for world peace and for the people of both Russia and Ukraine to bring this three-year-long war to an end. It's a war that I think a lot of us, when it broke out, were surprised to see actually take place. I thought that Putin would just engage in a lot of bluster and make a lot of noise and scare the Ukrainians. And lo and behold, I believe it's February of 22, if I'm not mistaken, across the Ukrainian-Russian frontier came the tanks, followed by the mortar shells and the rockets and everything else. We saw that country being blasted to bits. I figured one way or the other, I think most of us thought that if the war broke out, it would be wrapped up in a few months. But this has turned out to be, you know, almost like a World War I type standstill or standoff that's gone on seemingly much longer than anybody imagined and could drag on forever. So I think we want to see this put to an end because there's so much carnage on both sides completely senselessly. And hopefully there can be some consent, agreement where the Russians pull out. Perhaps they keep some territory. I assume that the Ukrainians will not join NATO, which is a big irritant to Russia. I personally would be nice if they joined NATO, but I always think to myself, this would be a bit like Mexico joining the Warsaw Pact during the Cold War. I don't think we Americans would have found that very amusing at the time. And I can see how Russians might not be terribly amused by Ukraine being part of NATO. They certainly could be part of the European Union and engage in trade and commerce and finance without necessarily engaging any kind of military activity or even a military alliance with NATO. And I think there's something brilliant that Trump did just a few weeks ago, which is this whole minerals deal. Zelensky has asked for security guarantees. And again, I think joining NATO is something that's beyond his reach at the moment, beyond something he can try to accomplish right now. But I think that the idea of having thousands, I assume, of American mining engineers, mining executives, mining equipment, mining investment in Ukraine will cause Putin or any of his successors to think thrice or four times before attacking Ukraine if there's a risk that the first mortar shell is going to come in and blast the head off of some young American mining engineer or some truck full of American mining workers or some meeting of people at some seminar someplace in eastern Ukraine, let's say. So I think that the mining deal is itself sort of a de facto security guarantee. And I would hope that Zelensky and the Ukrainians understand that. sign that agreement. And the U.S., I think, in a very, very clever way, can protect Ukraine through commerce while it has European peacekeeping troops on the ground, no U.S. forces, no U.S. boots on the ground, and Russia perhaps getting some bit of territory and everybody walking away from the negotiating table feeling as if he's achieved something. And hopefully all this useless and needless carnage and bloodshed can stop.
I'd be very struck, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this from usually the other side of the Atlantic. By the way, British commentators who are quite Trump sympathetic have, when it comes to Ukraine, they've decided, no, enough's enough. He's going too far here. He's being rude about Zelensky. We think Zelensky's a hero. And he's sucking up to Putin. We've heard this a lot. You know, you have quite a few columnists in British newspapers saying he's effectively not our friend anymore. He's Vladimir Putin's friend. That sort of rage. From what I understand, Americans just don't understand that. They don't think that having a phone call with Vladimir Putin is some sort of major shift in American strategy. What's your reading of it?
Well, I respond to one thing you said, which is Trump is not our friend anymore. If people in the UK believe that, I don't think that's the case. I think we've had a warm and increasingly loving relationship since, I'd say, sometime after the 1812, War of 1812, yeah. when you folks left our burning White House and went back across the Atlantic. We've let bygones be bygones, and the Anglo-American alliance is something of which I think both of us on both sides of the Atlantic are proud. Nobody can see it since this is an audio program, but I'm wearing a flag pin with both the American flag and the Union flag crossed in my lapel. At the moment, I'm very proud to wear that, and I always do when I come over here. So I think that the warm friendship between the U.S. and the U.K. continues. I do think that in terms of President Trump, as you say, sucking up to Putin, I think he has a tendency often in his diplomacy to butter up international officials in a way that makes them feel warm and toasty. And maybe once he has ingratiated himself to them, they feel more likely to come to the table and negotiate with this guy who's slapped him on the back and posed for pictures and all that sort of thing. You could say that you maybe lose a bit, take a step or two off the moral high ground if you do this sort of thing. But I think if you're trying to end a war, if what it takes is to say to a guy like Vladimir Putin, you know, hey, we can work with this guy. You know, he's not the worst guy in the world. Maybe there is some sense in that. I don't think I'm not sure there's a need to kick Zelensky in the teeth at the same time. You can warm the relationship up with Putin without necessarily throwing ice water down Zelensky's back. And I think Zelensky didn't do himself any good in the Oval Office the other day when he had that big outburst, which ended up with him getting booted from the White House and the minerals deal got put on hold and all that sort of thing. But I think that the behavior towards Putin, I think, is merely tactical. I don't think it's any type of a warm embrace of Putin's ideology or his policies or his thuggish behavior as much as it is just a way to warm the relationship with Putin personally and hope that that gets him to be more agreeable in negotiations.
And Trump's job approval ratings, his polling, they were going up. They do seem to have tapered off a little bit. Possibly it's economic anxieties causing that. But the golden age, which he's promised, has to come, or there will be significant disappointment from the electorate quite soon.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, he talks about a golden age, and we all want to see the golden age come, but the whole thing could turn to tin or rust if we don't get some sort of a rebound in the economy. Again, this is why I think Trump should be fully focused and pressuring the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans, who, by the way, are Republicans. This is his the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives all run by Republicans. So this should not be difficult to get them all focused, get them all on the same page, and pass this bloody tax cut already and get this thing signed. Again, I hope by April 15th. The House Republicans seem focused on getting this done quickly. The Senate Republicans seem to think, well, if we have a tax cut by Halloween or Thanksgiving, which is end of November, that'll be okay. And that's not okay. There's tremendous uncertainty as to what next year's tax code will look like. And until that's clear to people, they're going to have major difficulty saying, you know, let's build that warehouse or not build that warehouse. Let's expand the factory or not expand the factory. Let's purchase that asset or don't purchase that asset. It becomes a lot easier to make those decisions when you can figure out, okay, as of 2026, this is the amount of tax we'll pay on this stream of revenue or whatever else it is. Because the tax cuts expire at the end of this year, that's a giant question mark. And if you've ever done a spreadsheet, it doesn't end with a question mark. There's no question mark entry. You need an actual answer there. Otherwise, the box is empty. And if the box is empty, you can't make a decision. So we need that box filled so you know what those tax rates are and people can make clear economic decisions. If I were Donald J. Trump, I'd focus on that fully. I tell the Senate Republicans, you know, get off the stick and get your jobs done and push this. They should take the House bill that went through a couple of weeks ago and just put on the Senate floor and pass it. Move on to reconciliation, which is a very complicated parliamentary procedure to get past the need for 60 senators to approve a filibuster. You can get it done with a simple majority of 51 votes or 50 votes plus the vice president breaking the tie. And you can get a tax cut through that way. It can be a generous tax cut that keeps the low rates for under the current Trump tax cut system. If you are a company that produces in the United States, your corporate tax will drop from 21% to 15, which may be the lowest in the world. I think Ireland was lower. They may have gone back up. I'm not sure. But if it's not the lowest in the world, it'd be very close. Plus, as I said, no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security benefits, no tax on overtime, and all that sort of stuff. And you can put other things into it to bring taxes even lower. That's what I'd be focused on. And if that happens, I think the golden age will come very soon, perhaps as soon as this summer.
Do you think the free market right, for want of a better term, will forgive him on tariffs if he sticks with tariffs at quite high levels, if he does deliver these?
Well, that's interesting. I think that if the tax cuts come through quickly and the economy rebounds and takes off and bounces up to these great heights of which it's capable of reaching, that if we have a tariff situation that are, again, tariffs as a policy, not just as a tool, they'll be much easier to absorb if you have a thriving economy under them. If you have what we have right now, which is economy, which is still hobbled by the 4 years of Bidenomics, the Trump extended tax cuts have not kicked in yet. And then you put tariffs on top of that. You're just really what you're doing is you're amplifying the damage that Joe Biden did without the relief that Trump wants to bring in with the help of this Republican Congress. So again, I think the timing is totally backwards. I don't want to see tariffs as used as anything other than a tool. But if, God forbid, we are going to have them as a policy, they should follow tax reduction and the boom that tax reduction will allow. So if we do have tariffs as a policy, we'll be able to absorb those extra costs rather than do it now, which is just going to be, you know, one more heavy brick or one bit more heavy cinder block on the backs of the already overtaxed and exhausted American people.
And finally, because I know you've got to get off to the House of Lords, I would like to ask you about the Democrats, mm-hmm. because you were talking about this tax cut, you know, getting through by April 15th. There's this urgency, fierce urgency of the first Trump 100 days. And this sense among some Republicans that the Democrats are not going to be in this disarray for long. Do you think the Democrats are in any shape to recover politically following what was quite a painful defeat for them in November?
It was a very, very painful and devastating defeat for them. I think at some point, somebody in the Democrat Party may get their act together. Right now, what they really need to do to get themselves back into mainstream discussion is turn their backs on the far left. The people who've been pushing critical race theory, diversity, equity, and inclusion, even more noisome to the American public has been this entire transgender agenda. And again, not just saying, well, if you're over 18 and you want to remove your penis and turn yourself into a woman, you know, maybe we're not going to wave pom-poms and cheer, but go ahead and do your thing. There's something about the left over the last few years, they thought, you know what, we need to go talk to six-year-olds about this. We really need to get this into the kindergarten agenda. I know someone out in California who told me that his son was in preschool. And part of the curriculum for a little boy of 3 years old, not third grade, but age three, was a book about some little bear, and the bear couldn't decide, am I a boy bear or am I a girl bear? So this is being taught to three-year-olds. And a lot of people, not just on the right and the middle, but even people on the left say, my little boy, my little girl don't need to hear this. Thank you very much. Back off. And yet the Democrat Party is still, they voted just a couple of weeks ago, almost all of them, to keep men and women sports and not to take any steps back on the transgender agenda. And as long as they keep pushing that, the American people are going to keep recoiling and running the opposite direction. So at some point, the Democrats have decided, look, are we going to be a center-left party, which has an opportunity to win elections, or are we going to be a bunch of far-left radical wackos that will be ideologically pure, like the Black Panthers, perhaps, some of these other far-left radical organizations, and be very pure, and they can pound themselves on the chest and you know, be very in love with their own virtue signaling, or are they going to try to move away from that, move towards the center at least a bit, and again, be taken seriously. I don't know if they're capable of doing that. I hope that they're not, and I'm quite frankly welcome them continue to go over the cliff and fall down into the abyss below.
Gavin Newsom, the Democratic governor of California, now has a podcast. Is he going to reinvent himself as the face of the Democratic Party through his podcast? I think he thinks that.
I think he's going to try. But the thing is that if he's going to reinvent himself, what he really should do is reinvent California, which is my home state, Jeremy Hildreth's home state. We grew up out there. And it's very sad to go back and visit California, which at the time I was growing up in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, as a child and adolescent out there, it was the place where everybody wanted to be. The entire world was flocking to Southern California. It was then what Florida is today. That's where the jobs were, where the innovation was, the movie studios were there, the defense plants, all sorts of high-tech innovation, et cetera. And now you look at it, and it's basically poverty and homelessness and fires. And it's very, very sad. And if Gavin Newsom wants to reinvent himself, what he'd do is reinvent California. And he could start by building reservoirs to collect water. So when people are thirsty, they can drink. When there are droughts, they don't end up with the farm area, the Central Valley, turning into a dust bowl. And when fires break out, you actually have, imagine this crazy idea, water coming out of fire hydrants. Yeah, I know you heard it here first. It's a radical concept. But yeah, water hydrants with water coming through them. That would be nice. So I think if Gavin Newsom can focus on getting the water to come out of the water out of the fire hydrants in Southern California when the fires break out, that would be a big step towards him turning himself into somebody who can take seriously as something other than just governor of an increasingly and very tragically failed state.
I think DeRoy Murdoch for governor of California. DeRoy, thank you very much for coming in. It's always a great honor to have you on.
Freddie, great to be with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening into it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.